There's no free lunch when it comes to investing. But what about a podcast that delivers educational content on investing, financial planning, items of interest, and even the odd wacky topic? Welcome to the Free Lunch Podcast, hosted by Canvas Wealth. Free Lunch will bring listeners the team's vast knowledge and experience in dealing with uncertainty. Learn more and subscribe today at canvaswealth.ca.
Welcome back to the Free Lunch Podcast with Greg and Colin. And Greg, a very special guest today.
Very excited today, for sure.
You are excited about this one.
Yep.
I can tell from your demeanor. I can tell from your smile. And it's really, really neat to see. Because today we're joined by one of the true giants in behavioral finance, Dr. Mayer Statman. Mayer is the Glenn Klimek Professor of Finance at Santa Clara University, one of the most influential voices in understanding how real people make real decisions. His work has been published in virtually every major academic and professional journal, and he's written several really prominent books, including What Investors Really Want, Finance for Normal People, and his newest book, A Wealth of Well-Being. And I'm just really excited to get this conversation going as well, Greg, so I'll probably stop the intro there, other than to say, Mayer, the highlight of most people's career is to be on the Free Lunch Podcast. So welcome to the Free Lunch Podcast.
Oh, I'm delighted to be with you, Greg and Colin.
Well, let's kick this off. Mayer, can you give us a bit of your story? I'm sure you have a long story, but maybe just for the listeners, provide a little bit of background as to how you got to where you are today.
Well, you know, I've always been interested in how people behave. I mean, every kid grows up interested in how is it that people around him or her are thinking. And when I chose my majors at the university, I thought that economics is going to be about people in the context of economics. And it turned out that it was not. You know, there was kind of like a wooden model of people who are rational, just trying to maximize their wealth and immune to any emotions or cognitive errors. And that was funny to me. But, you know, I worked to get my degree, and I did. But when I found out the work of Kahneman and Tversky, suddenly the world changed. Suddenly I could see answers to questions where data, evidence, and theory were clashing. And people in finance to this very day, if there is a clash between theory and evidence, they dismiss the evidence and say, no, it is the theory that is wrong. And when I was at the Hebrew University in the late 60s, Amos Tversky and Danny Kahneman were actually working in the building right next to mine, but I had no idea of who they were. None of my professors mentioned their names. You can see how different the world was then.
For sure. Yeah, absolutely.
That's really interesting. So on a side note, are these people that you've spent time with then over the years?
Well, later. And so when I got to Santa Clara University, I met Hersh Shefrin, who was a colleague of many years, and he was working on a subject with Richard Thaler, who subsequently won the Nobel Prize. And he was investigating the issue that really is of interest to investors and advisors of people's saving and the problem of self-control and why it is that it is hard for people to gather the self-control necessary to gather the savings that they will need for retirement. And then it occurred to me that this issue is really the key to understanding why it is that people like dividends. Because rationally, if you don't get your dividend from the company, you create homemade dividend by selling a few shares to get the whatever $1,000 that you expected. So why don't people do that? Why is it that when Con Edison, the energy company of New York, suspended its dividend when we had the energy crisis in the late 70s, Why is it that people were so mad, wanting to kill the chairman of the board at the annual meeting? And then it occurred to me, I know why. Because if you create those homemade dividends, say by selling 3% of your shares, well, you might be tempted to sell 6% because now, you know, this week is kind of tight and I would like to have some more and so on. And people just don't think that they're going to have sufficient self-control to control themselves. And so this rule of don't dip into capital is so important. A friend of mine says there is just one thing worse than incest, and that is dipping into capital.
a deadly sin, it sounds like.
That's really interesting because we've had that dividend discussion many times over the years with investors. And, you know, especially in Canada, there's a big, I don't know, framework around owning dividend paying stocks, get paid to wait, etc. And Greg and I have often told people like dividends are just a form of return of capital. I mean, whether you take it yourself or they pay you, it's kind of the same thing, isn't it?
It is. So I'm not dismissing the rational approach. The rational approach is generally the smart approach.
Yes.
But there is something there, and you cannot really say that people are stupid. People are normal, and they make a distinction. We make a distinction between what is capital and what is income. And so we move money easily from income to capital, as we put money in the U.S. as 401k, and in Canada you have the equivalent of that. But the problem, I'm sure that you encounter it, when people get old and somehow they've accumulated lots of saving. I remember somebody in Canada who talked about professors as being accidental millionaires, and I understand that. They find it really hard to change the habit from saving to spending. And I could see it myself, you know, that is what, a decade ago or so, that I finally caught myself and I said, hey, Mayor, you are a rich man. Stop behaving as you are poor. Yes, I know that business class tickets are expensive, but you are old and well off. So pay up and get some sleep.
Good advice for everybody. What do you got, Greg?
Well, I'm just wondering, I mean, sort of you've from Finance for Normal People, which was a book that I read years ago. And it had lots of discussions about a variety of things that you further elucidate in your new book. So maybe you could talk a little bit about your new book, A Wealth of Well-Being, and maybe outline how that, you know, how have things changed or how do you see things differently than you did, you know, with your previous book?
So, you know, I often say, you know, the biggest risks in life are not in the stock market. I say, if you want real risk, get married. And if you want more risk, have children.
Yes.
So people laugh, as you do, because once I say that, the point is really obvious. You know, of course it is so. And yet, when we are talking about finance, people just think about the money part. You know, the stock market is going to crash. What will happen? Well, yes, this is bad, but it surely is not as bad as divorce and not as bad as kids who don't do what you want them to do. And so the point I'm making is that it is stupid for us in finance to narrow ourselves as if finance is the beginning and the end. You know, I tell this apocryphal story about a man who comes to the advisor in early 2009 and all shaking, you know, lost a good chunk of his money. And the advisor says, what are you complaining about? I put you on the mean variance efficient frontier. Yeah, I'm concerned I'm going to live in the street and eat dog food. You know, that's what I'm concerned about. And so the point I'm making really is that I'm trying to expand the circle of finance. It is not a frontier. I'm trying to expand the circle of finance to include all of life. And so in a way, in this earlier book that you mentioned, Finance for Normal People, I talked about about what people in marketing know very well, which is that all products, including financial products, have utilitarian, expressive, and emotional benefits. And somehow in finance, we just talk about returns, about utilitarian benefits. But when people buy automobiles, they don't just buy them by gas mileage and price. They also want some pizzazz, you know, some status, some roar of the engine, you know, that makes them go and possibly attracts women. You know, all kinds of things go into people's mind. And you know, we laugh, but of course, we know they are true. You know, well, why would you buy a Lamborghini? You know, they are not reliable. They are expensive. They are noisy. They are uncomfortable. But
yes,
they are eye candies.
Exactly.
And so people. So I'm just saying, hey, there is more to life than money. Yes, you need money for everything. You need money for family. You need money for health. You need money even to go to church because they'll expect you to put something in the bowl. But things like family matter once you have kind of this foundation of money. It is family. And within family, it is dating and marriage and children and widowhood and divorce. And you have issues of friendship and work and health and religion and so on. So, you know, how is it that we are just blinding ourselves to all of life by just thinking about finances, a bunch of numbers? And people do those silly exercises where how much can you spend out of your money in retirement, blah, blah, so that you don't run out of money before you run out of life. And as I always say, the real problem for many people, it is the problem of running out of life before running out of money.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
You know, I see that we're fortunate enough to work with some pretty wealthy individuals. And it's always interesting to me to hear somebody that has tens and tens of millions of dollars concerned about running out of money. And I just think, how? Like, that doesn't even make sense, you know? And we've had people in the past that have overspent and you do get concerned about them and they don't seem to have a care in the world or they appear not to. It's such an interesting dynamic when you're dealing with those people.
Yeah. So the work of advisors is kind of complicated. It's hard and it is really very, very beneficial. And so that those different people, sometimes you have to tell people to hit the brakes. And sometimes you can tell them it's time to press down the accelerator. You know, yeah. you can spend some more. When I talk about, say, business class tickets, you know, somebody writes, well, you know, I'm going to be on a plane for 5 hours. So why should I pay thousands of dollars extra? I say, because you have that money and it is really nice to be able to take a nap rather than, and what will you do with this money? You know, you just cannot take it with you.
Yeah.
And you know, that, what are going to be the richest man in the cemetery? When Nava, my wife, and I established an endowment of several million dollars at my university. And when I told that to my younger daughter, you know, she said she was very happy with that. You know, I said, there's going to be plenty left for you. And she said, you know, I already received my inheritance. Is it is right? Because she received already in many ways, down payment and so on, more than $1 million, you know, that is, there are not very many people who are so fortunate. And fortunately, she is really a very level-headed young woman. Mm-hmm. And she knows how lucky she is to have wealthy parents.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, for sure. I think maybe I could have used your help, you know, in raising my kids, but that's a subject for another podcast, I guess. In your book, you talk about something called a life portfolio. So, what is a life portfolio?
So, we all know what a portfolio of securities is. So you have stocks and bonds and real estate and the other investments. Well, you have domains of life. And so you have money as one part, like a security in the portfolio, but you also have family and friends and work and health and education and so on. And what I'm saying is think about it as a portfolio. Now, there might be the reason we diversify our investment portfolio is because we don't have perfect foresight. So we don't know which stocks are going to go up and which of them are going to go down. And so we buy a whole bunch of them, hoping that we are going to have more securities that go up than down. Well, the same happens in life. That is, there might be some people who have perfect marriage, perfect children, perfect health, perfect work. Everything is perfect. I have not met them. once you speak to people and you told them about your imperfect life, they tell you, you know, Mayor, my life is not perfect either. So in our case, it is having an older daughter who lives with bipolar illness. And so our portfolio is not perfect. But what we do is with the security portfolio, we take the high returns in some. So money we have a younger daughter who loves her older sister and helps her, and we kind of compensate for where we are missing some. And it doesn't really, you know, different people form different portfolios. For some people, their work and career are the most important things. For some people, it is being a parent. For some people, it is health, sports, other things. I don't think that there is like a pyramid where there is something kind of at the very top, self-actualization, whatever that means. I think that people, I think about it not as a pyramid, but rather as a rectangle where people kind of choose to emphasize different things. Some people think about pets as children. Mm-hmm. It really is hard for me to understand that, really understand that. Even though both my daughters have cats and no kids, when I sit next to a person who is holding a small dog in his or her lap during the flight, I think this is ridiculous. And then I say, okay, Mayor, think about it and imagine that it were a baby. Do you understand that? Yes, I understand that in my bones. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I can make that intellectual jump. But do I feel that? No. So when I allocate in my life well-being portfolio, pets are in very tiny script.
Yes.
And probably in a color that says that they are on the negative side rather than the positive. So that's what I'm saying. You know, they still have maximization as in a securities portfolio, but realizing that not everything is going to be perfect and learning to balance things and learning about finding well-being, even if not everything is perfect.
I was just thinking as you're saying that, going back to that, as I said, fortunate enough to work with some pretty wealthy people. And I remember as a younger person, I would get intimidated when I would be in meetings with these people. They think, oh, their lives are just perfect. They have all this money and they have nice cars and big houses and nice vacation properties. As I've gotten older, I've started to realize, well, those people also have their own hopes and fears and dreams, and you don't really know what's happening behind the scenes for them. That's kind of what you're saying, right?
Yeah, and I think that the good things is that if you disclose your less than perfect parts of life, they are likely to disclose theirs. Mm-hmm. That is, when I speak to people about my daughter, my older daughter, one, they invariably offer empathy. And second, they will tell me something about their lives. Mm-hmm. A divorce, you know, kids who are not behaving exactly as parents would want, health trouble. You know, I had a friend who did everything right, exercised, ate right, was frugal. He had something that seemed like an ear infection, and that caused him to lose his balance. He went to be checked, and it turned out that it was advanced cancer. He died in his very early 60s, a bit more than a year later. You know, that's why I remind myself, man plans and God laughs.
Yep.
And stuff happens. And so be kind to yourself. Be kind to the people around you, those that are family, friends, and the larger community. Because however unlucky you are, there are people much more unlucky who can use your help.
Yeah, absolutely. Top that, Greg.
Well, you know, one of the things that, and this maybe we'll get back to some of the things in the earlier generations of behavioral finance, but certainly, you know, behavioral finance draws strongly from psychology, and because we're talking about people and how they think and how they behave. And there's and the big difference that's talked about, of course, with behavioral finance is, well, how does that tie in to, say, things like efficient market hypothesis, which would seem to be, you know, sort of in contradiction or maybe not. But I'm thinking about just with Colin and my practice over the years, we went through a fundamental change ourselves as advisors, as, you know, theoretically professional investment, you know, advisors. Back after the 2009 global financial crisis, where we finally learned the lessons that many people have tried to teach for years, and that is, okay, well, trying to beat the market as a fairly normal person, and I would argue that most investment advisors like ourselves are pretty normal people. You know, when I got into the business, it was all about stock trading and could you pick the best stock, and after 2009, we decided, well, this doesn't seem to make sense. And so we discovered at that time the beauty of efficient market hypothesis in terms of just being able to build well-diversified portfolio where you didn't do any harm. You know, you wouldn't blow the markets away, but you wouldn't have people losing money when the markets were doing just fine. But the thing that happened at the same time for us is that we also started to look at, and not to the extent that you're doing, obviously, but more of a taking more of a planning-oriented approach. But how do you think that marriage of traditional finance and behavioral finance, how does that play out for people today, whether it's for individual investors, for financial advisors, and so on? And I guess I think of the story of Eugene Fama and Richard Thaler, who are good friends and go golfing together. And I'm wondering, so how does traditional finance and behavioral finance, how do they go golfing together?
Oh, well, you know, they are thinking people. And so even if they have differences in terms of their perceptions of markets, they can surely communicate. And when you speak with Thama or Thaler or Bert Malkiel and so on, you will find that, say, this notion that the biggest achievement of behavioral finance is overturning the efficient market hypothesis is nonsense. There are two notions of market efficiency. One, where price is always equal to value of securities. And the other one is where price deviates sometimes a long way from value. And so you had bubbles, positive bubbles and negative bubbles, but you cannot tell when you are in the bubble, okay? You will know later. Yes. You will know in 2000, in after 2009, you will know that we have had, in fact, a negative bubble, and it would have been very wise to buy stocks at the bottom. And so it is important to distinguish them. The reason I don't try to beat the market is not because I think that price is anyway equal to value. It is because I don't know what comes next. I don't know how to beat the market. And so I just leave things alone, and it really adds to my peace of mind. Now, standard finance teaches us very useful things. You know, it teaches us, for example, that hindsight is not foresight, as the first generation of behavioral finance showed. It teaches us that more trading is likely to cause losses relative to the benchmark rather than gain. So if you tell people, look, you know, you're a day trader because you think that you're beating the market. But if I look at your record, you're actually losing money relative to the alternative. Now, they might say, oh, now that you tell me, and now that I look at the data, I'm going to stop doing that. But if they continue doing that, you know that the problem is not lack of knowledge, but they just find trading fun. In fact, just the other day, I saw a paper that showed that when people retire, they trade more. Why? They have more time to play with it. And so they do that. And so it is not that they get stupider as they get old. It is just that they have more time to do stupid things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, over the years, we've had lots of people that get focused on rate of return and am I beating the benchmark, et cetera. And you're right. We have all those tools to measure volatility and we can do all the analysis, too much analysis at times. What Greg and I have come to understand over the years is that most questions we get are framed around market timing in some way. And the root of the question is usually, am I going to be okay?
Yeah. Okay. So there are actually two things that are different. One is, am I going to be okay? And I think that is a very important task of financial advisors to really evaluate that. If the answer is no, then, you know, you'll have to save more, you'll have to work longer and so on. But if the answer is yes, if your fear is for nothing, then they can learn from you that that is a worry that they should set aside. Market timing, you know, that is, people just find that because markets go up and down, people find it irresistible to look for a pattern. You know, we are pattern seeking beings. It is natural for us to try to find a pattern. We have a friend. He did just that. What is the pattern? Is he moving away from our friendship? Or this is not second nature. This is first nature to us. The stock market just looks like a pattern. And if I can just figure it out, I can buy low and I can sell high. Mm-hmm. And the problem really is that sometimes those perceptions that we have are wrong. And in this case, they are very wrong. And so if we can get people to understand that in hindsight, you see the patterns and they're very easy. In foresight, forget it. And so give up on trying to beat the market. Here's a story about 2009. So I was speaking at the conference to financial advisors in May of 2009. And the bottom was really in February or March. So we were already on the upswing. But that was not obvious at that time, mm-hmm. because markets go up and down every day and you don't really get that kind of pattern. Now we know where the bottom was. People were walking ashen faces. One financial advisor who I know said, I have lost two clients, a father and son, an adult son, and they told me that I ruined their lives. Mm. What happened? It turned out that the grandfather promised the father that he will pay for the education of the grandkids. Now that money that was dedicated for that was gone, or halfway gone. And the advisor never asked the people, what is this money for? And what will happen if you lose half of it? For him, he just assume that this is kind of extra money that you can just put in stocks and everything is going to be fine over the long run. And so, you know, coming to the point that you say, you have to understand people, not just market. Mm-hmm. And understanding people is more important than understanding market. I don't watch the market, you know. I mean, I hate it when the market goes down and my portfolio shrinks. Mm-hmm. But I just shrug my shoulders, you know. It's very good exercise. and, you know, I just let go and I focus on those things that are really important. My students, my scholarship, my family, wife, children, community, and so on.
So you brought up a good point, and that is, as wealth managers or as investment advisors, as we make that shift, which I mentioned, we tried to start that shift, you know, back in after the global financial crisis. But what do conversations between advisors and their clients, what should they look like with this new, you know, focus more on well-being as opposed to return stock returns or something like that? How do you see that evolving in the role of the we play?
So I think that the first question or issue to discuss is not the what the Fed is going to do next and whether NVIDIA is going to go up and down. It is about your family. And so, you know, one advisor told me years ago about a couple that came to him and they said up front, you should know that we have a disabled son and we would like to set a fund for him such that he is supported long after we are gone. Now, this is a wonderful case where somebody, a client, comes and sets it up and says, here is the thing that matters most, my children, my life well-being and theirs. But many clients or prospects come with the expectation that you know where the market is going.
Yeah.
Yes. And you have to really sit them down and say, tell me about your family. What is going on? Any disabled kids? Any divorces or pending divorces? Any things at work? Anything in health? You know, you have to do it, of course, carefully. But you can see why it is really important. And also, think about it this way. The stuff that advisors do on the market side, you know, portfolio rebalancing and so on, that's generic. Even without artificial intelligence, what is going to bind advisor to client is that emotional connection. And that emotional connection is kind of like moving from being an acquaintance to being a friend.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Friend knows about you some things that are kind of private. You know, they know about things that are not perfect. And so that is what you should do. One advantage, I think, of my book, of my recent book, is that when clients read that book, A Wealth of Well-Being, they're going to see themselves in it, in some of the stories, and they're going to see other people. And this can create an opening, breaking the ice between advisor and client, or at least deepen conversations if client and advisor are already speaking about those personal issues. And you can ask questions. So for example, when Nava and I got married, I was 22 and she was 21 and we are still married. Our parents sent us for a walk and they sat down to business and businessmen figuring out how much each pair of parents is going to contribute to the young couple to get them going, down payment on an apartment. Mm-hmm. Now, some people say, no, I worked really hard. I paid my way through college and so on. And let those bastards do it themselves, you know? And it seems ridiculous to me. Some advisor said, isn't it a matter of values? Of course it's a matter of values. Figure out those values. Say in different cultures, they do it differently. What do you think? You know, if they insist that the kid wait until they die at 95 and they're 65 to get some money, you know, what can you do? If maybe you can get them thinking that the time that kids, young adults need the money is when they're in their 20s and 30s, just struggling to... Mm-hmm. To establish themselves.
For sure. And even more so these days, it seems, than when we were growing up. Yes.
In our area and in many areas, both in Canada and the United States, getting money for a down payment on a house is really heavy lifting. Mm-hmm. And if you If you rent and you save for down payment, that is doubly hard because you have both of these, and your income is likely to be on the low side. Mm-hmm. This really means that as parents, this is a time for us to give, not just wait until, you know, they're praying, God, please take them away so I can get that inheritance.
Well, and you know, I mean, I just saw a statistic last week that the median age of first home ownership in the U.S. is now 40 years.
Yes.
You know, and I think it's up from 26 years old 25 years ago or something. Yeah. It's dramatic.
So what happened really was that the price of houses and apartments has gone up more than income. But I think that it also means that the culture has to change. And, you know, people are not so stuck that they say, no, my culture is that you don't give money to adult children. They can think about it. You know, the kid is now pressed. The kid works hard. The kid is responsible. But, you know, there's just so much that they can earn at this stage. And there might be a baby. There might be, you know, just the other things, or even buying an engagement ring for a girlfriend. This is the time to help. And you know, it is nice when your kids say something like, I already received my inheritance, when they are grateful and you can see the good that your money is doing. So you know, think about it. You know, I think that these are issues to raise with clients. And this really is where you act, you know, I talk about advisors as well-being advisors, not wealth advisors, but yes, well-being advisors. And I say it's analogous to good physicians. You know, good physicians speak about people, about, you know, embarrassing things. You know, some stuff is kind of, you know, I don't want to talk about this kind of stuff. But, you know, you speak about it with physicians, and physicians are attuned, hopefully, if they're good. You know, they kind of listen between the lines and they take this into account. And you can, as a physician, kind of provide people information, even if it is hard, like cancer. And at the same time, they understand where they stand and so on. So they're still shocked, of course, but they are doing as well as can be under the circumstances.
Absolutely. Well, listen, Mayor, we really appreciate you taking the time from your day to share your thoughts with us and our audience. As I said at the beginning, I know Greg was super excited for this discussion, and we just feel really fortunate to have you on the show.
We could talk for hours, but that wouldn't be fair to you.
Be like the Joe Rogan Experience.
That's right.
Talk for 8 hours.
Yes, exactly.
It is a delight to speak with you, and I hope that the listeners would benefit.
I'm sure they will.
Thank you very much. Thank you again.
Yeah. Thanks, Mayor.
Take care. Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to the Free Lunch Podcast hosted by Canvas Wealth. To subscribe to this podcast to get more realistic insights on investing or to connect with one of our talented partners, please head on over to canvaswealth.ca. We'll see you next time on the Free Lunch Podcast.
Financial planning services are offered through Canvas Wealth. Portfolio management services are provided by Q Wealth Partners, a registered portfolio manager, investment fund manager, an exempt market dealer. Canvas is an owner and partner in the Q Wealth Partnership. The information discussed in this show, including any opinion, is based on various sources believed to be reliable, but subject to change. The opinions expressed in this show are opinions of the individuals, and they have not been approved by, and are not necessarily those of, Q Wealth as a firm. This is not legal, accounting, tax, or investment advice, and should not be relied as such.